This is the Taylor Report. We're on SoundCloud, Taylor-Report, and we're on Facebook, The Taylor Report, according to last time I heard. Gowans is now gowansblog.com. But, of course, you just put the name in the machine, and it comes up anyhow. Phil Conlon is here. That was interesting, don't you think?
I loved every minute of it. You know, over the years on Taylor Report, we've interviewed a couple of guests who've talked about Zimbabwe. Many years ago, we interviewed an academic who lived in South Africa but did a lot of research, and she was a woman from Toronto. And I remember her saying, nobody in Africa has any problem with him, and I don't see any problem with the way Zimbabwe is being run as a society. And I thought that was great. Here was this sociologist, a political scientist who was from Toronto and who actually lived in Africa and actually sat in our studio and said, listen, there's no problems. You know, the press can invent a crisis. If they decide to invent a crisis, they're going to invent it. And to believe them, people have been starving in Zimbabwe for the last 20 years. But you know what? There's still people in Zimbabwe. So somewhere along the line, that story kind of lost its credibility.
Yes. Yeah, and for those who say, I mean, this is... The sanction game, which is the U.S. has upped it now. I mean, they're deep into sanctions for anything that moves. And then they say, look at that, the economy's in trouble. They don't even have medicine. Then you say, well, but you don't sell them medicine. You won't let them have medicine.
Yeah. Sell it to them, but you tell other banks in other countries, you better not sell it to them or we'll cut off your ability to do business in the U.S.
Yes. Yeah. And then they say, but it's not our fault if they don't have the medicine. So I would say, why don't you just stop the sanctions? By the way, you claim they're incompetent. So if they're incompetent, what's the sanctions got to do with it? So end the sanctions, see what happens. You know, for example, you see they have a lot of minerals, they have rich land and all that, but they need a line of credit in order to be able to do something. But anyone extending credit to Zimbabwe is immediately hammered with sanctions. And therefore, they're lying through their teeth. Remember, those sanctions are coming from the blue-eyed part of the world. It is the EU and United States. And both are saying the same that they always do, do as we tell you and otherwise starve. And really, since the beginning of colonialism, that's always been the story. You capture somebody's territory, he resists, you deny him food, water, and make him, pardon the expression, crawl. That is the game. So there's nothing very fancy about it. I recall to Stephen Gowans, of course, his story, and this is one that interests me a great deal, again, because I was in Tanzania at the time this happened, the invasion of Congo by Uganda and Rwanda. And I recall Madeleine Albright really liked it. She thought it was wonderful. And she even, they gave her credit for calling it Africa's first world war, which I always thought was about as lame a story as I could imagine, but somehow it was somehow significant that she'd put a label on a war. But the story, a little detail that I often tell on the Taylor Report to remember about that, because I'm addressing sometimes people who call themselves leftists in North America. When Uganda and Rwanda crossed the border and began their attacks, and then they had a very sophisticated movement of troops by using civilian aircraft, they landed near Kinshasa, but also near the Atlantic port of Congo. When they did that, Kabila disappeared for a few days, President Kabila of Congo. And then there was a picture appeared. I invite you to look it up. Of Kabila in Havana shaking hands with Fidel. There was no story. it said Kabila is visiting Fidel with no reports, no press release. Then later he was back in Congo, and Angola came to the rescue of Kabila, and they beat off the Rwandan and Ugandan troops, which were not, according to all the news agencies, not identified as the troops of Uganda and Rwanda. It was lied about. They said they're rebels, except that the leader of the rebels was a Rwandan general, Kabaribi. Isn't that funny? Now, Samuel Nujoma of Namibia, he called a meeting of this organization that I referred to in talking to Stephen of the Southern African Development Community. Sam Nujoma of SWAPO, one of the leaders of the liberation struggle against apartheid regime of South Africa, he called out his counterparts in the South African leadership and said, "You're failing in your duty, and we're going to do our duty. We're not going to stand by while these two countries attack a fellow African country." So Angola stood up, and Namibia stood up, and Zimbabwe. And because of that, they were the Kinshasa, Kigali, and Uganda, they were unable to capture Congo, which had been their goal. They had captured it previously. They had provided the military muscle when Kabila seized power. However, as Samuel Njoma said, Kabila has democratic tendencies, and they didn't like that. He actually was going to listen to the people, and they did not appreciate foreign invaders. They maybe didn't like Mobutu, but they definitely did not want to be ruled from Kigali. And so Kabila asserted himself and told the Rwandans and the Ugandans they had to go home. And they left, but they turned around and came back. I want to underline over and over that they lied through their teeth. It was, they said they weren't, it was not them, but it was them. And this is very important. And Africa did have a kind of a moment where, are we going to sit by while these running dogs for the imperialists play their little game, or are we going to put a stop to them? And Robert Mugabe and Samuel Njoma and Dos Santos of Angola did their duty. And it was a great victory, a tremendous victory. It ended, as these things often do, in slowly negotiating everybody's an end to the matter. But it was certainly significant. And I'm very happy that I'm reading that the Southern African Development Community is going to have a day of solidarity with Zimbabwe, calling on EU and the US to end their sanctions. That is very positive.
Phil, can I add a note about the courage that was shown by Zimbabwe and Angola and Namibia in these circumstances? When the Soviet Union collapsed, and the Americans, of course, said, well, history is over, and you guys in the third world don't have any big friends anymore, right? So you better do what we tell you to do. And this intervention in the invasion of Congo was done by three African nations that were very much within the crosshairs of the imperialists, and they didn't have any big friend. They just relied on their own people and the support of their own people.
Well, Fidel.
Yeah. Fidel was their big friend.
As close as it came.
There you go. Fidel was the big friend.
Right? Yeah. And by the way, at that time, Fidel, that was...
the special period, right?
They were trying. Cuba was being. The move was to try to starve them. This was 1998, and Cuba was really under the gun. But they, you know, you're right. They stood up. This was the remnant that of the anti-colonial struggle that refused to bow. And actually, later there was comment that they said that they had meetings. Even at the time, Samuel Njoma said that, the South African leaders are not of one mind. And he said, as a matter of fact, he named a couple. He said, they're coming to understand our position. At first, they were opposed because they were getting phone calls like crazy. I bet it was ringing off the hook from London and Washington saying, you know, don't get involved because we want Uganda and Rwanda to take over. But the position of the three prevailed. And on the matter of decolonization, which has been going on and it is far from over, there's a funny link here that we ought to also point out. About a week ago, 2 weeks ago, a tape recording of Ronald Reagan talking about black people, but about Africans, using terms like, you know, a monkey, etc., was made public. We finally learned. And by the way, it's at the Nixon Library, because happily Nixon was an egomaniac and he taped all the phone conversations he had. So he wanted history to know what a smart fellow he was. So he got the phone call from Reagan, who at that time was the governor of California. And the focus of the stories has been that, wow, Reagan's big racist. Who knew? You know, that kind of stupid, you know. But they don't. Let's talk about why he phoned. He phoned Nixon in a completely outraged because the African countries at the United Nations had voted to recognize the People's Republic of China as the government of China, and taking the seat away from the phony government in Taiwan, a U.S.-supported little gang. And what Reagan was mad about was that these Africans had done this. And then he said the Africans don't even wear shoes. I mean, he was out of his mind. But you got to remember the content. Africa was in the forefront of saying, let's end this situation where the leader, the government of at that time probably 700 million people, now 1.4 billion, that they were, that because of the U.S. hegemony, U.S. and British hegemony, China was represented by the little army in what is, they people call it Taiwan. Little detail there, by the way, little footnote. They don't call themselves Taiwan. Look it up. They call themselves China. So you're in for a lot of trouble. I mean, Hong Kong is just warming up. They have been playing this dirty game for a long, long time. They're not winning, but they won't quit because, you know, rust doesn't stop, right? But just to get the story straight, it was the governments of the newly liberated governments of Africa that insisted on the recognition of China, People's Republic of China, as the true representative of the Chinese people. And that sent Reagan into his racist outburst. And I'd argue, by the way, every significant issue of racism comes back to that. Something significant happened that caused the verbiage, that everybody condemns the verbiage, but they forget about the content. So you're listening to The Taylor Report. We are on SoundCloud. We are on Facebook. I think we have, is it Angolan music or what was the other kind? Namibia. So Angola. We're going to have their national anthem because we all take our hat off to Angola today. Thank you. So, we're back, Taylor Report. By the way, we spoke earlier with Stephen Gowans, and I urge you to go to his article, and because we want to reflect on the life of Robert Mugabe. The Toronto Star did a feature on him, and they mocked him and told all kinds of stories, which had nothing to do with anything, actually. But they dealt with the matter of sanctions in the middle of the article. It was written by Oakland Ross. And a little quote shows up. It says, and the truth is, he wasn't entirely off the money when he talked about sanctions. And then you have a quote, 50% of what Mugabe says about global inequities in the interests of the West is probably correct, commented a Western diplomat in Harare during the latter years of Mugabe's rule. He's not that far wrong. Mr. Ross, I would have put that at the beginning of the article, and maybe out of a little Western humility. Not that far wrong. But then, of course, he says, oh, never mind, I'll go back to throwing mud at him. And so he did. The rest of the article is just mud. Something important has happened in Syria. I really urge you to go to Max Blumenthal. He has a great Twitter account. They'll take it away from him, so go to it now while he's still got it. And he's the in charge of the Gray Zone. I just gave him a job he probably doesn't have, but he seems to be one of the guys in charge of Gray Zone. But he's visiting Damascus. And Max Blumenthal is a very sharp character. And he's been on top of a lot of the big stories, particularly Venezuela and this matter and the unending U.S. aggression against Syria. And it's great that he's there because he takes quick shots. He's getting really good at video and all that. There's some Canadians there. It's a trade union movement of Syria. Sponsored the meeting. So I just urge you to follow Max Blumenthal and Gray Zone, because this is the time you're going to get maximum opportunity to see the real story. And so urge you to do that. There's the issue that I would want to mention that I think is important. Boris, what's his name? Johnson, Bojo? His father commented when he was made the leader of the Conservatives. Somebody said, well, golly, he inherits a real problem, doesn't he? I mean, they just seized an Iranian oil tanker, off Gibraltar. And meanwhile, now the Iranians have captured a British vessel in the Strait of Hormuz, saying that it committed an offenses, and they're holding it. Your son is really in a jackpot. He said, oh, no, we can just trade it off. He said, no problem. And, you know, at the time I thought, he's as crazy as Boris. But actually they did it. And this is interesting because Mr. Bolton said he didn't want that to happen. Bolton said, hold on to the tanker. But I think the British really understand that if you do that, you become a pirate in front of the whole world. So they decided a local judge in Gibraltar said, let it go. And then so then they said, okay, let it go. And it sailed on. Now, because of the sanction games, it went to toward Greece. It was off the coast of Greece. But it couldn't go into a Greek port because the Greek government said, if we allow it to dock, and if we allow it to offload the oil, then we will be subject to U.S. sanctions. So there was really only one other port, and that was, oddly enough, Syria. Now that tanker, the Iranian tanker, I thought I heard a foreign voice. That tanker is offloading its oil, and that oil is going to be enough to see the Syrians through a tough winter. They have tough winters too, you know. So this is really quite a story, and I know it's, you know, Boris is easy to make jokes about, but he did actually a smart thing, and my understanding is that the Iranians are going to release the British vessel. And I would say, for those of you who are following the hallway business, You might think about this. Suppose we had a leader who could actually do such a thing. Apparently, the British leader still has a degree of autonomy. That may all go by the boards if they jump out of the frying pan into Trump's fire. But at the moment, I'd say, let's just note that it happened. It's quite remarkable. And it could have something to do with the fact that the Islamic Republic is a country of 70 million people, highly sophisticated, old culture, capable of defending itself, and not a weaker power, but a stronger one. So everybody ought to be, maybe even the, you know, the guys who have to do the heavy lifting might have called the boss and said, man, don't ask me to do that. They'll break my neck. It's entirely possible. So to my mind, that's a story, and it's not been told well, because to tell it well would be to admit that the British conceded Iran's position, that they had no legal right to capture an Iranian vessel on the high seas, which is important. Takes us back to the War of 1812. Americans said, you can't seize our vessels or we'll go to war with you. Americans, of course, have forgotten that. That's why Gore Vidal calls it the United States of Amnesia. It doesn't remember anything. In the remaining moments, how many? Yeah, he whispered in my ear, I'm going to show you my hand. And I got my, okay. So, the NFL is back in business, and Mr. Kaepernick is still not playing.
That doesn't come as a surprise.
It's the freest country in the world. Yeah. You know, you can pursue your dreams, but not here, you know, somewhere else. And don't tell anybody you have any dreams. If you're a famous football player and you say, I don't like the way black Americans are treated, the incarceration rate, the murder of black youth on the street by police officers. Oh, no, 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 no. You cannot play sports and have an opinion. So Mr. Kaepernick remains a martyr to the pretense that it's a country that values individuals and freedom of speech, etc. And rather, they prefer to have the military holding flags that cover the entire stadium. And then have a jet airplane fly over and urge youth to join. And in Major League Baseball, they were told you can't play winter ball in Venezuela because of sanctions. So, strange enough, Phil, I heard the man say the other night, you know, this kid, I like him, he ought to play some winter ball. And I said, well,
where is he going to do it, right?
Venezuela is a great place for winter ball, and it produces some of the greatest baseball players. So those are among we call the end notes of our work. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. By the way, Indigenous Waves is going to be coming up shortly. I'll just say again that I am really impressed that young people in Hong Kong are carrying American flags, asking Trump to liberate them, and they know all the words to the American National Anthem. And I tell them something just from here. You are kidding yourselves in Technicolor, as they used to say. This is inviting a superpower to attack your own country. The issue now clearly is sovereignty. And there isn't any question about it. And that matter is settled. All this new rhetoric is about challenging the sovereignty of China over its own territory. And that is a democratic question, by the way. You know, if you can have a meeting in your country if you want, and the Americans rarely have any where they talk substance, but you can have a discussion about what you think might your relations ought to be with that other country. But you better make sure you don't think about attacking it, because you'll be in violation of international law and the UN Charter, and you'll also lose, by the way, a little small detail. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. I want to thank Phil Conlon and Mick and We'll see you next week.